I'm Dave Heller, and this is NewsWorks Tonight. Ahead this evening, Pope Francis's Philly visit is shaking up several plans, even a concert fronted by an anti-pope. First, Pennsylvania Attorney General Kathleen Kane addressed reporters this afternoon for the first time since she was indicted last week. Kane maintained her innocence in response to the allegations that she constructed a scheme of political revenge against her detractors, broke grand jury secrecy rules, and then lied about it on her oath. Kane says the indictment is the work of those seeking to distract her from her investigation of pornography and offensive emails traded by government officials.
Some involved in this filthy email chain have tried desperately to ensure that these emails, and more importantly, their attachment to it, never saw the light of day.
Not only did Kane pledge not to resign, but she called for a Montgomery County judge to lift an order blocking the release of those emails.
I do that not as a part of some vendetta. I do that to begin to tell the truth and the whole story. A story that is critical to my defense against these charges.
WHYY's Mary Wilson was among a cohort of reporters on hand in Harrisburg when Kathleen Kane spoke, and she joins us now on NewsWorks Tonight. Mary, thanks for being here.
Thanks for having me, Dave.
It was a bit of a bait and switch. Kane took no questions, though this was advertised as a press conference.
That's right. Her spokesman had been told to schedule a press conference. It's not clear to me if Kane herself made it explicitly clear that she was planning to take questions. Her spokesman told the press to expect to be able to ask questions and have them answered. And, you know, a lot of people were really surprised by that. She is a criminal defendant here, and you would think that any defense lawyer worth his or her salt would tell her, you know, anything you say can be used against you in court, so don't say much. So we were surprised, and then it became clear this morning that she was advised by counsel not to answer questions, so she read a prepared statement.
And she says she won't answer questions until this Montgomery County judge complies with her wish to lift an order blocking the release of those emails.
That's right. She says that the story of the charges against her and her fiercest critics, she says this begins with her investigation and uncovering of raunchy emails exchanged by state prosecutors and judges, among others. And she says that she can't release all of those emails because of a protective order issued by the judge that that directed a grand jury to investigate her last year. She did not address directly what that has to do with the allegations against her. And I should say here that some of the charges against Kane and against a special agent and a driver, Patrick Reese, stem from the fact that she allegedly violated that protective order by directing employees to search emails of the Office of Attorney General to stay one step ahead of the grand jury investigation as it targeted her.
So what was the consensus among reporters assembled? Is it much ado about a good offense being the best defense?
I think the only thing we can say here is relay what Kane said, which is that the whole story is not yet out there, and she certainly seems to feel like she's being asked to fight charges with one arm tied behind her back.
Now, in the days since the indictment was read, many, including Pennsylvania Governor Wolf, have called for her to resign. In the hours since this press conference, have any of those positions shifted?
No, not at all. The only development in that vein is you're starting to see the machinery ramp up for her ouster. There's been at least one public complaint filed with the high court asking it to suspend her law license. Let's say somebody filed a complaint right after she was charged last Thursday. Kane would have up to 10 days to respond to that, and then the Supreme Court would issue an order, a final determination. So it could be several more days before we see anything, and we would not know. These are confidential proceedings unless the Supreme Court does issue an order to take her law license, or suspend it, I should say. So you've got that going on. The legislature, leaders of the legislature, have hinted that they are considering getting the ball rolling on impeachment proceedings. We have seen those hints from the House. But most people think it's very unlikely that the legislature is going to take that on. That is a lengthy process, and it is expensive.
One date on the calendar, August 24th, that's when Ms. Cain is scheduled for a preliminary hearing.
That's right. That's right.
We'll see what happens between now and then. Thanks for joining us on NewsWorks Tonight.
Thank you for having me.
In a sign that the opt-out movement continues to grow, the number of elementary school students who refuse to take Pennsylvania's state standardized tests rose dramatically over the past 2 years. Details from WHYY's Kevin McCory.
Between last school year and the previous, the number of elementary school students refusing to take the state's standardized test in math and science more than tripled. The year-to-year difference in those refusing the English Language Arts test fell just shy of that mark. Adam Schott is the director of research at Research for Action.
It's a recognition that there's already substantial concern among some parents about the climate with standardized testing. And so it's just important that policymakers be attentive going forward.
While the jumps are high, total opt-outs still represent an extremely small fraction of the state's students. In most subjects, the percentage of total students refusing the test in the past 2 years rose from 0.001% to 0.005%. But even that small fraction can make a difference, especially if opt-outs are clustered. Research for Action ran a hypothetical example based on a school just above the state's quality threshold. With 100 kids in tested grades, if 11 high-performing students opt out, the school would sink below the threshold, putting it in line for potential financial consequences. News of the opt-outs comes on the heels of major performance declines on state tests based on the implementation of more rigorous standards, when New York experienced similar drops for much the same reasons in 2011, that state's opt-out movement exploded into the mainstream. For WHYY News, I'm Kevin McCory.
Turning to this evening's headlines, authorities say a New Jersey man spent the night clinging to a buoy after his personal watercraft broke down. Coast Guard spokesperson Charles Rowe says 19-year-old Dylan Gowan left a personal watercraft rental business in New York City for the Highlands in New Jersey when the craft was swamped last night. Gowan was taken to a hospital for treatment of dehydration and hypothermia after being found northeast of Sandy Hook Peninsula earlier this morning. Federal safety officials who reviewed the 2014 New Jersey Turnpike crash involving comedian Tracy Morgan were sharply critical of the emergency response. They're urging the state to establish minimum standards. Governor Chris Christie vetoed legislation overhauling the system in 2011 and 2013, citing cost concerns. A health department spokesperson says the state already has some minimum standards in place. 84 degrees, sunshine on Independence Mall. It's 6:14. You're listening to NewsWorks Tonight on WHYY. Partly cloudy this evening and then clearing skies overnight, low 66 degrees. Enjoy another sunny day tomorrow. Thursday's high in the low 80s. Sunny days Friday right through the weekend. High each day approaching 90. Still ahead, the evolution of Pittsburgh's waterways from industrial avenues to public spaces.
This is a Bayliner, 32-foot Bayliner. The name of the boat, Tranquilo. Be cool. Calm down. Yeah.
NewsWorks Tonight continues on WHYY.
Eastern University supports WHYY. The College of Business and Leadership programs educate and empower students to lead in the global marketplace. With various MBA programs, including management and health administration, and both a master's and PhD in organization leadership, Eastern believes the world responds to those who believe and do. Their programs are designed to empower students to develop skills that impact the world around them. Eastern.edu/empower. Eastern University. Don't just be, do, and wake up the world.
You know, foreign investment is usually a good thing. Usually.
These are foreign investors, these are money launderers, these are South American drug dealers hiding their money in London.
And then sometimes it's not so good. I'm Kai Rizdahl, London Real Estate, next time on Marketplace from APM.
Tonight at 6:30 on WHYY.
WHYY volunteers help with everything from membership campaigns to exciting events to day-to-day tasks, and their valuable time and effort keeps costs down and maximizes the generous financial support of our members. If you or your group or business is interested in volunteering, please visit whyy.org/volunteer and enter your information. Groups that answer phones during membership campaigns even receive on-air recognition. Public media would not be possible without people like you. whyy.org/volunteer. Thank you.
Welcome back to NewsWorks Tonight. I'm Dave Heller. There's been a big emphasis on developing waterfronts in Pennsylvania cities, and with its three rivers, Pittsburgh is a great example. A bird's-eye view over the heart of the city reveals parks, stadiums, museums, and marinas all build up along the picturesque waterfronts. Keystone Crossroads' Irina Jarove and Kate Lau Schaffner walk us through the history of Pittsburgh's waterfronts and explain that, like many other Pennsylvania cities, large and small, its waterfront development is kind of a new idea.
Irina and I recently went for a weekend stroll at Point State Park. It's a triangle of green at the very place where the Monongahela and Allegheny Rivers meet to form the Ohio River.
This is kind of what I think of as ultimate Pittsburgh. There's like the 10th Street Bridge, the 16th Street Bridge, the Smithfield Bridge, you can see them all. And then the rivers. There's a big old fountain at the very point, and there's a rainbow right now.
It's really just pretty.
It's so pretty, and there's just tons and tons of people here.
As early as the mid-1800s, people went to the waterfronts to have fun.
Rowing competitions with rowdy keg drinking, fishing.
The rivers were also important transportation routes, the Ohio as a gateway to the west. This didn't last. Pretty quickly, railroads took over. But then big industry came. The steel boom turned the rivers strictly commercial.
They were a source of water for industry. They were a source of dumping waste for industry.
That's Ted Muller, historian and professor at the University of Pittsburgh. A few people still swam in the rivers, but they basically had to trespass, cross railroad tracks, and pick their way through mill yards to get to the filthy water.
This idea of the rivers as purely industrial was official city policy. Muller says in the 1920s, the city plan basically said as much.
It says boldly there, these rivers are commercial assets, and the commercial uses have the priority, and only with land that is not being used and left over can the city use it for public amenity. That's clear as a bell.
We should also point out, people dump their waste into the rivers, too.
And at the same time, that's where their drinking water came from.
Gross.
At the turn of the 19th century, out of all the big cities in America, Pittsburgh had the highest death rate from typhoid fever, about three times the national rate. The first drinking water treatment facility went up in 1906, but sewage didn't get treated until later.
Just after World War II, city leaders and private investors put together a bold 25-year renaissance program focused on improving quality of life. The goal was to address environmental issues in the city, diversify the economy, redevelop the downtown, and build infrastructure projects like sewage treatment.
Point State Park, where we strolled, was the city's first waterfront project and played a key role in bringing the high-rises and complexes you see downtown today. But the change of perspective to maximize waterfronts was gradual. Case in point, the new convention center, which opened on the banks of the Allegheny River in 1981, still had city views, not water views.
We walk from the point across a pedestrian bridge, part of the waterfront trail system in the city. We find Dan Hennessy relaxing on his boat.
This is a Bayliner, 32-foot Bayliner. The name of the boat, Tranquilo. Be cool. Calm down. Yeah.
He brings his friends, his co-workers, his family out on the boat.
This is what we do all summer. One of the things we like to do is take the boat, go over to Station Square, tie up there, walk, take them up on the incline. All starts right here.
He's been coming to the river for 50 years, and he's even been swimming in it all this time.
Sure, I don't have any hair, but is it the river's fault?
He remembers when industry dominated the waterfronts.
Oh, how'd this place look? It looked nothing like this. It was industrial, it was depressing, it was dirty. There were, factory-type businesses all around here.
He saw the transformation of the point and cheered on the slow pivot to more waterfront development.
there wasn't much else to cheer. Rethinking waterfronts was driven by the sharp decline of the city's industries in the 70s and 80s. Closing steel mills and factories freed up lots. The city turned lemons into lemonade by reclaiming those areas.
Here's maybe the perfect illustration of the change in perspective. Remember that convention center that was facing away from the water? Well, they actually redesigned it in the 1990s, this time with giant windows to maximize the waterfront views. The 90s also brought planning for two stadiums on the North Shore, and in 1999, a task force formed to work on more comprehensive waterfront plans for the first time.
By the turn of the new century, the city was well on its way to the waterfront Hennessy enjoys today. He's on the water all summer long.
Everyone comes down here. I mean, this is the place to, this is it.
But it's not the end of the story. For one, many people we spoke with at the point say there's actually not much to do there. They want even more from their waterfronts. But also, the city's ongoing challenge is to replace the economic engine that was the waterfront industry.
Hennessy, for one, says to secure Pittsburgh's economic future, rivers still have an industrial role to play.
He just hopes the rivers can stay pretty.
That was Irina Zhorov and Kate Lau-Schaffner. Keystone Crossroads is a statewide public media initiative reporting on the challenges facing Pennsylvania cities. WHYY leads the four-station initiative. And to see more in our Urban Waterfront series, including an interactive map, check out keystonecrossroads.org/waterfronts. Profiting from Philadelphia's upcoming papal visit has practically become a competitive sport. Enterprising businesses are selling everything from Pope Francis bobbleheads to special beer. WHYY's Katie Culinary introduces us to the local man behind one of the most popular Pope tchotchkes on the market.
There's a place in the Philly suburbs where Pope Francis hangs out with superheroes and sports stars. It's a one-story building in an office park in Plymouth Meeting. That's where I met the guy who brought them together, Matt Hoffman.
Hi, I'm Matt.
And you brought the Pope with you.
He sets down a plush doll of Pope Francis between two similarly stuffed versions of Ant-Man and basketball star Kobe Bryant. It's not the company the humble pontiff normally keeps, but this union is pretty typical at Bleacher Creatures, Hoffman's company known best for making plush toys that look like popular athletes.
Bleacher Creatures are plush figures. They're a cross between an action figure and a soft toy.
Hoffman did not start out looking to cash in on the papal visit. The idea for Bleacher Creatures came to him 5 years ago during a Phillies game. It was a hot night in August. Citizens Bank Park was packed, and Hoffman was sitting in the stands with a group of friends when he started looking at second baseman Chase Utley and asking himself a bizarre question.
I looked at him and I said, what would Chase Utley look like if he was a Muppet, and would people buy it?
At the time, Hoffman worked for Majestic Athletic, the company based in Easton that makes uniforms for Major League Baseball and sports clothing for fans. When he traveled to stadiums on business, he had trouble finding good presents for his three young daughters.
You know, once you got past a T-shirt, a pair of socks, and sort of a cheaply made mascot, there was nothing to get.
1 year after that Phillies game, Hoffman founded Bleacher Creatures. The company's grown to include characters from Marvel and DC Comics and Rocky Balboa. The dolls are manufactured in China, but the process starts in Plymouth Meeting, where a small team of illustrators and graphic designers spend hours turning well-known figures into cuddly caricatures. In 2013, Hoffman was on the phone with some distributors from France. They were working on a plush version of former French President Nicolas Sarkozy when one of the distributors asked, "What about a plush pope?" Hoffman had no idea that a year later, Pope Francis would announce a visit to Philadelphia.
I literally had a Pope Francis Bleacher Creature prototype on my desk when we found out, and I got a bunch of emails and phone calls, my partners, different customers.
Maybe it's because plush Pope is just so fun to say. Or maybe it's how uncanny the doll's resemblance is to the real thing, from its warm, friendly smile down to sporting the same style of cross around its neck. But since hitting the market in late June, plush Pope Francis is the company's number one seller, with more than 50,000 sold across the country. Hoffman says they'll be sold out by the end of this week.
Somebody said to me, "What's your next Pope?" I said, "Well, there's no one out there that has as many fans or followers." So I think when you do the math of how many Catholics are out there and how they've been connected to the Pope, it makes sense he would be our best seller.
The plush is one of many pieces of papal merchandise being sold in the World Meeting of Families online store. Web ads for the doll encourage clickers to shop the Pope. It's a message that, like so much of the merchandising around the papal visit, is in stark contrast to the message of Pope Francis, a staunch advocate for the poor who's criticized unfettered capitalism. Hoffman knows that's what makes Pope Francis and his plush likeness so popular, even among non-Catholics like him.
I think Pope Francis's message is we should be more tolerant. If people are different, we should understand that. Maybe rules need to change for the 21st century, and that's really important to us.
Hoffman vows he has a plan to give some of his own windfall back to those whose lives are considerably less plush. Katie Culinary, WHYY News.
And while Pope plushes may be flying off the shelves, not every papal-branded plan is running smoothly. Security measures surrounding the visit by Pope Francis next month are forcing many places to close on the weekend of the 26th and 27th, and that includes museums, theaters, and nightclubs. It's also forced the postponement of a concert by the anti-pope, as WHYY's Peter Crimmins explains.
Ghost is a Swedish heavy metal band with a highly theatrical show. It dresses the stage as a satanic mass, and the lead singer, who calls himself Papa Emeritus, appears in skull makeup wearing a black papal headpiece. In the time-honored tradition of heavy metal, Ghost plays with imagery of demonic religion. The band was booked to play Philadelphia the same weekend as the visit from Pope Francis. To promote that show, it released a video.
Children of Philadelphia, you are a special city. We have been pleased with growing unrest and incivility toward Frankie's visit next month.
The band was booked to play the Union Transfer on September 26th. That show was booked by promoter Sean Agnew, who thought he had a coup on his hands, Ghost versus Pope.
The band also wanted to get really creative and have their own ghost motorcade where singer would, you know, go around the city. We had all these great ideas, create an alternative to the Pope. But more and more news stories were starting to come out about the lockdown. We started having to scale back.
In the end, the real Pope won. Not only would fans have a hard time getting to the concert because of limited train service, Agnew says the band's tour bus would not be able to pull up to the venue because the Union Transfer is inside the city's restricted traffic zone, the traffic box. The band postponed the show until the following Tuesday. I'm Peter Crimmins, WHYY News.
Time to give up the ghost. NewsWorks Tonight is produced by Shai Ben-Yakov and Kimberly Haas with help today from Brett Rader. You can listen again to a story or catch up on a missed show via podcast or online at newsworks.org. Sunshine, 84 degrees on Independence Mall, 82 in Wilmington. Clearer skies overnight, low 66 degrees. Tomorrow, sunny. Thursday's high in the low 80s. Sunny days Friday right through the weekend, high each day near 90 degrees. Thanks for joining us. I'm Dave Heller for NewsWorks Tonight.